All right. I'm Rick Hansen. It's July 15th, 2015, right? Okay, good. And last time we were here, 2 weeks ago, I talked about why do we practice? And we practice, okay, for ourselves. There's a place for that. But we also practice for other people. We do so out of love, and to some extent, we do so out of enlightened self-interest, pragmatic self-interest. And we explored what it's like to actually, from time to time, or have continually in the background of your mind, the sense that you're doing your practice for others. You're trying to recognize things more deeply, you're restraining problematic desires and behaviors, you're becoming more mindful, more compassionate, abstaining from things that are not good for you, for other people, not just for yourself, and see what that does for your practice. And to see what it's even like in situations where other people are being, okay, aggravating one way or another, that you find in your heart a kind of softness, a lovingness, as an exploration. So that was last week, and I linked that, of course, why do we practice, for those of you that have a familiarity with the Buddhist tradition, with the notion of the bodhisattva. One way of thinking of it is someone who really takes on a kind of fundamental stance of service and love and support with regard to other people, other beings, all beings, including mosquitoes that annoy you. All right. So that was why we practice. Tonight, I'd like to talk about what we practice. What do we actually do in a very, very deep and far-reaching way? And I've been reflecting that one could apply what I'm talking about here to practice outside of a Buddhist frame. So I'll talk about this in part in the framework of Buddhism, including its historical developments over 2,500 years. But you might think about this in terms of what we practice as a kind of possible way of thinking universally about just about any path. So to begin, I recently read a very powerful summary statement which said essentially, suffering comes from seeking happiness where it cannot be found. Isn't that a very pithy summary? It's even memorable, you know. Suffering comes from seeking happiness where it cannot be found. It's not just happiness cannot be found where you can't find it, but the search for happiness where it cannot be found is both doomed and makes us suffer. And that shows up at two different levels. At the gross level, we search for happiness where it cannot be found in the realm of objects. Other people, money in the bank, certain kinds of jobs, roof over our head, physical pleasures, sweet desserts, and so forth. Different activities. And it's not that those are bad things to do. The Buddha's demonstration in his own life is that the path of asceticism, that's life negative, is just another strategy to seek happiness where it cannot be found. But I think we've all had the experience again and again and again that you think, okay, I'm just going to get that thing. I'm going to have, you know, that relationship with that person. I'm going to get that cool car. I'm going to have that wart removed. I'm going to upgrade my profile on Match.com. I'm going to have that cool meal with my friends. You know, the 49ers are finally going to win a championship again. Something like that is going to happen, and I'm going to have lasting, deep fulfillment, happiness, in a word, contentment, inner peace, peace of heart. I'm going to have that from that thing. And I think we've all had the experience that it's nice to have those things, you know. It's nice to have that college degree. It's nice to own that home. It's nice to fix the tire in the car. It's nice to make that nice bowl of pasta. But do we ever find lasting happiness in things? I haven't. It just can't be found there. And part of the path of wisdom is recognizing the mechanics of suffering. You know, recognizing that getting caught up in trying to really, really get that thing in ways that are stressful or problematic for others creates suffering. And even when you have the thing, and again, some things are good to have. You know, it's good to have food in the fridge. It's good to have a refrigerator at all, right? But when you have that thing, does it actually bring you that lasting peace your heart longs for? I doubt you'd be in this room if you found lasting happiness, lasting, profound contentment and fulfillment that your heart longs for in the realm of things, broadly defined, including other people and activities. So part of what we do when we practice is we gradually begin to recognize our failed strategies, which is pretty irritating often, to realize, dang, it's not going to work. It didn't work, it's not going to work. And then you think, but if I just perfect that strategy, you know, if I kind of upgrade from the basic Honda to an Acura, you know, or whatever the upper middle way, you know, takes you toward, right? You can go, but still, it doesn't do it for you, right? And then the subtler level comes in, where you start to recognize, oh, this is really interesting. I'm not so much seeking happiness where it cannot be found in the realm of things. I'm seeking happiness in the experiences various stimuli give me, which is really what we're trying to do, right? The frog goes after the fly, not so much because the frog wants the fly, but the frog really wants the experience the frog will have upon eating the fly. To use a kind of real metaphor, but a truth. We ourselves, it's not so much that we want the plate of pasta itself, or that fantastic erotic experience, or you know, the event of our child graduating from high school. I mean, we may want those facts for other people, but in terms of our personal quest, we want the experience. And so what you start to become more and more aware of as you sort of move from the gross level of analysis of the mechanics of suffering, you start realizing, oh, more and more, it's about my relationship with my experience. The Buddha recognized the existence of stuff, things, but he wasn't very interested in it. He was really interested in our experience. So you start realizing, oh, this is very interesting. And you can watch your mind. You can watch it happen. Every day is a fantastic graduate school, world-class course in the mechanics of suffering. Right? You just, right? You watch your mind. Something happens. So I'm going to tell you a personal story. And it's embarrassing, so get ready to be titillated. But anyway, it's true. Okay. So I go on retreat, and I notice this often, and I even noticed it, and I began to notice it on retreat because my mind was quiet enough to notice it. And then I began to observe, this happens in the mind, it arises. You know, less and less, you'll see why in a moment, I'm pleased to be able to say. But I think many similar kinds of things happen for people. So I'm going to kind of confess my own deal here, and then you can see what the analogies might be for you. So there I am on retreat, heterosexual male, and my mind's really quiet, and it's a sexually abstinent environment, the retreats I go on. Days go by, week goes by, and then the mind's quiet enough to notice that really calm, really peaceful, quite fulfilled, quite content, the eye, over the course of about half a second, recognizes some appealing female shape. Then, about half a second later, comes the sense of it being kind of pleasant. And also with that is also maybe another half second later, the beginning of a sense of the anticipation of or possibility of more pleasantness there. Okay? And then on the heels of that, another half second or so later, comes desire. Okay? Ah. And then on the heels of that comes suffering. I can't have it. Not going to get it. Can't have it. Frustration. And then comes on the heels of that recognition. Oh yeah, this process, yet again, right? The cookie dangled, hand reaches, suffering, right? And then, a minute later, another curved body part appears in the periphery of the view. And the same thing happens again. It's kind of interesting. And so you start to recognize things like that. And it becomes, and again, you hopefully recognize them, with compassion for yourself. You realize the conditioning, including just biology that does that. And you also recognize more and more as a kind of an impersonal process. But that's the nature so much of the machinery of suffering at the experiential level, the level of phenomenology. In other words, intangible perceptions occur, stimuli of various kinds. So we have thoughts. We start planning something in our mind. We imagine a certain situation with another person. Oh, I'll talk with that person like this, and they'll respond like that, and I'll feel good, and I'll feel liked, I'll feel important, I'll feel popular, I'll see in their eyes that I'm impressive, all that, of course, it's 3, 4, 5 seconds in the mental simulator, right, the little movie running, and you can start to see that we're believing those experiences and we're reifying them, we're making them into things, static entities that somehow we can hold on to. And you start to recognize more and more this machinery of trying to hold on to pieces of experience, which is doomed because experience is constantly changing. Experience is insubstantial. It's made of many parts. It's empty in the technical sense of any absolute self-nature. And usually the experience isn't that great when you finally actually have it, because we live with a kind of inner ad agency in our heads that's constantly generating anticipated pains or anticipated pleasures that are rarely as intense as the actual ones when we eventually find them. Because that inner process is a great way to motivate lizards, mice, and monkeys, and human beings to do what they can to avoid those pains and get those pleasures. Even though again and again and again, when it finally happens, they're rarely as intense as promised. And then there's a kind of amnesia that occurs because that's adaptive for survival, and we do it again. In Buddhism, there's this fundamental thing called the chain of dependent origination. It's this basic sequence of events, and it has different parts, but there's one part in particular that's very down-to-earth and psychological, and the sequence goes like this. It's called contact. There's a stimulus. Something arises in the mind, often from internal sources. There we are. We just find ourselves thinking about something. Oh yeah, I gotta go get some food for dinner. Oh yeah, we're gonna have dinner. It'll be a really nice dinner. We'll get closer to the children. It'll be nice. Perfectly wholesome, perfectly okay. But already, you're reifying the event, creating the experience. It's gonna happen, I'm getting attached to it. And somehow in that experience, I'm gonna find lasting happiness. So contact, a stimulus arises, then comes its feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, often anticipated pleasant, or unpleasant, or neutral. Then on the heels of contact and feeling, which is very quick and very unavoidable and no problem so far, okay, including, liking something, enjoying it, right? Contact, feeling, craving. Suddenly then we want the pleasant, we want the unpleasant to go away. We're reifying our experiences, we're making them solid, ba-boom. Then comes clinging, we really, really get into it, and then a couple steps later comes suffering. And you just watch that process. That's what I'm trying to describe here. So So over time, we start recognizing both doom strategies at the level of stuff, and also more fundamentally and importantly and universally, we start recognizing this sort of doomed, well-intended, very poignant, adaptive for survival, but utterly deluded inner strategy for lasting happiness that is doomed to failure and actually makes us suffer because we're constantly caught up in this search. So what are we going to do about it, right? By the way, the Buddha left a town, came back, found that a bunch of monks had committed suicide, had been listening to his teachings, which I don't want to leave you with right here. And he counseled. He said, no, it's a big mistake. Trust me, it's a big mistake. There's some good news coming. Okay. So the interesting thing is that I think, probably for you, certainly for me, there's a sense that when we kind of give up or we drop the strategy, we just accept the mind as it is. We stop chasing things. We accept ourselves. We stop trying to fix ourselves. We stop trying to fix experiences. We stop trying to perfect the world, perfect the minds of other people. We just kind of give that whole thing up, often because we're brought to our knees by something, or because we've had all the goodies and we've had tons and tons of great experiences, and deep in our bones there's this feeling, really? This is it? For whatever reason, at some point, the process stops. Or maybe we're just doing something or sitting under a tree or folding laundry and there's a piercing moment of, boom, truth. And in that moment, we have this feeling, we have this intimation, we know, if only for a second, that there's something better underneath the whole process. Something, some kind of abiding peace, some purity, some spaciousness, some light, some love, something beyond language, some mystery. You know, distinct from that whole search process. And so then what we practice, and you can see this by other terms often, but what we practice when we practice is both a disentangling from that strategy of search that's doomed and a growing openness to the other thing that's true. The other thing that's true is really pretty hard to talk about. People point to it metaphorically. They refer to it as things like true nature, great self rather than small self, the ground. People talk about what else is true besides the search when the search falls away, and sometimes only at the level of mind and matter, without any reference to anything transcendental. Other people experience this and talk about it in reference to something transcendental. I can go either ways. I speak both dialects. I could do either one. I'm a transcendentalist, but that said. So how do we put those two together, though? Because often the effort to disentangle from the search, to gradually clear the mind of the factors that drive the search, greed, hatred, delusion, heartache, restlessness, remorse, just overwhelming guilt or shame, whatever it is, desires to pile up narcissistic rewards of various kinds, whatever it is, or to train the mind spiritually. Sometimes that process of disentangling from the search can become a subtle search itself. So how do you balance those two? And that's what a lot of teaching is about in terms of what we practice. How do you balance them? And there's some lovely language about this that I just want to pass along to you. One piece of language about it is a quotation from Suzuki Roshi that I dropped into my meditation suggestions earlier, in which he says, enlightenment is letting go of this moment while growing into the next one. So you can see right there, falling away of the search, letting go, and being right at the edge of now. Letting go of what's whooshing behind you, opening into the next, and then not clinging to that one either. Because as soon as you start thinking about it, it's become essentialized, it's called, reified, thingified in the mind. Yeah? And that practice. Okay? Another quotation from the Zen tradition that Suzuki Roshi's in, this is a classic statement from the third Zen patriarch who wrote this piece that you may recognize. It begins, "The great way is easy, the path of awakening is easy for one with no preferences." Right? And he means preferences there in a problematic sense, again, of the search, the drivenness. But somewhere, but in that piece, he says, enlightenment is no anxiety about imperfection. There too. It's a very important point. We may be pulling the hand away from the hot stove. We may be trying to figure out why our second grader isn't reading very well, right? We might be growing our business, trying to get people to come to our pizza parlor. Okay, there's a place for that. But without anxiety of any kind, any sense of insufficiency or imbalance or fundamental threat, without anxiety of any kind about imperfection, which means, of course, not trying to perfect the imperfectible mind. Okay? Another way of talking about this is Tibetan, and they say moments of awakening many times a day. In other words, popping out of the search. We're going to spend, you know, most of our time still caught up in the search until we're fully enlightened, right? Or parts of our mind will be caught up in the search while other parts are standing outside that search process looking at it going, I'm still doing that, I guess. Got to accept it because otherwise that's more search, right? Okay? But meanwhile, we're still in the search, okay. But still, every so often, piercing through moments of awakening many times a day. Or a similar way of putting it, sudden awakening, sudden illumination, gradual cultivation. Sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. A way I liken it is to, in an appropriate metaphor, the mind is like a temple or chapel with stained glass windows that are covered in mud, maybe cement, really thick stuff. And what practice is, one part of practice, the part of disentangling from the doomed strategies and the strategies that harm us and others. Part of that way of thinking about that process is that disentangling process is to gradually clear out the gunk off the windows. So the light, the true nature, what's also been the case, can shine through more readily. And every moment of sudden awakening, where you just suddenly get how it really is, you pop out into everything, in a way it's a little bit like putting a little tiny pinhole in a big sheet of black paper. Pinhole by pinhole by pinhole by pinhole, more and more the light starts shining through. Right? And over time, pinhole by pinhole by pinhole, that paper of the psyche becomes increasingly lacy and transparent to and accessible to that which is also true. And you feel more and more given over to it. So, a couple headlines here. One headline from practice in terms of disentangling from the search is to develop what's called in Pali nibbida, a word that sometimes is translated as disgust. People, I think more accurately and more usefully these days, translate it as disenchantment. You're waking up from the spell. You start to recognize more and more, oh man, it's kind of a doom strategy. I could tell you myself, it's more and more in my bones, working its way down to my mammalian reptile brain that, dude, there's no cheese down that tunnel. It's never, ever going to work out. You know, it kind of sinks in more and more deeply. And even more broadly, you just start to disentangle more and more from the search strategy. So insight. Insight in real time. Often the insight happens after the fact. You replay the inner movie, the last 3 seconds, the last 3 years, and you go, wow, that's, you know, that there's no, that one's never going to work, right? That's a doom. There's, that bird will never fly. That dog will never hunt, right? That one's just never going to work. Another thing we do over time is that we really slow down and steady our mind so we can actually see what's going on rather than being caught up in the rushing trance of the ordinary state of mind. So you might ask yourself, okay, how can I, you know, in real ways, bits and pieces every day, work on steadying this mind so I can slow it down and I can see more acutely through meditation and through other trainings? And also, how can I have more insight and more just getting it about the doom strategy? And then third, at this level of disentangling, really encouraging self-acceptance. That's been a huge one for me personally, to just kind of accept this mess as it is and disentangle, you know, from trying to perfect it endlessly and to kind of give yourself a pass. You really can kind of say to yourself, sit yourself down, you know, Mary, Bob, Rick, whatever, you know, you really have done enough. It's okay. You don't need to perfect yourself anymore. Plus, it's hopeless. You know, doesn't mean, you know, not trying, you know, not, here's where the art is. You kind of open to wholesome qualities shining through more and more. But the sense of tension around it or drivenness around it, the anxiety in it, the trying to prove to other people, all that other stuff that's added, that just falls away. Ain't going to happen. Don't have to do it. And you don't have to perfect the world. That doesn't mean giving up on social justice. It just means dropping the drivenness around it, the suffering of it, and the selfing. So much selfing and all that around that. So you might again explore, what would it be like to just give yourself a pass? You did it. It's okay. I'll give you a pass. Come up one by one, you know. Feel free, globally, honestly. I may not know you well at all. I can honestly say you don't have to fix yourself anymore. It's really okay, or the world. Right? So there's that part, okay? Then the part about increasingly resting, having more moments of sudden awakening and starting to stitch them together more and more. I want to name three things, kind of based on how the brain works, that can help us there. One is to hang out in the now. The great teachers, Eckhart Tolle included, talk about the power of now. They're right. You know, there's so much in wisdom traditions that it's all about really coming into the present moment, continually letting go. And what that does neurologically is that it disentangles us from the simulator where we're trying to, how can I put it, we're not in the now in the simulator. Right, when we're fantasizing or ruminating or, you know, planning, we're not in the now. We're kind of in this dreamlike state a little bit. And we're also not engaging this neurological network that has to do with being alert, alerted, that first registration of experience. And training in meditation and training in life to feel like you are at the front edge of the windshield of consciousness as the bugs and wind land. Continually, at the front edge of this moment of now, letting go instantly and not holding on and not trying to organize what's happening right now or even necessarily understand it. You know, not necessarily doing this practice all the time. Maybe there are certain situations where it wouldn't be appropriate, but at least much of the time, exploring what is it like to feel like you're right at the alerting edge of the moment, letting go, you know. Not needing to know what's happening, just here, letting go. That's good practice, and you can do that. Do it in meditation, do it walking across the lawn, just kind of imagine time streaming this way or moving forward through time, perhaps, however you like to do it. right in that intentional network, which also, by the way, is very involved with, as I've talked about before, what are called allocentric networks in the brain that have a sense of being one with everything. So training in sometimes what's called just sitting in Zen, Shikantaza, or a choiceless awareness in the Vipassana, Theravadin world, or whatever you like to call it, just being now, being here now, Ramdas put it, all that is fantastic training into what's really true, other than the search. Second thing to do is increasingly try to open into the whole of experience. Can work to start with the whole sense of breathing, then the whole body, then experience as a whole. Because what that does is it automatically disentangles you from parts, and suffering is only involved in parts, and it takes you into mind as a whole. And when you start just having like flashes, sudden awakening of, wow, mind as a whole, not getting metaphysical, not getting cosmic, there is hearing, there is seeing, there is awareness, there are sensations, there are thoughts, there are memories, all that's happening, and it's a whole process. It's one whole. You could think of the neural substrates underpinning consciousness. Networks mainly in the midline, kind of spreading out in the back, supported by other stuff underneath. You could think of all that as one whole process, dynamically changing, but in any moment, it's one whole process. And when you go out into mind as a whole, you just notice instantly, there's no suffering in mind as a whole. Mind as a whole might contain an aching back, heartache about a friend who's in real trouble, whatever it might be, you know. But mind as a whole, there's never a problem in mind as a whole. Problems, if you watch your mind, it's always about parts tussling with parts. And also when you go out into mind as a whole, that naturally tends to take you out into a larger sense of everything. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's probably, in my experience, the most articulate, developed account of the nature of mind as a whole. Because you start to recognize that the nature of experience, any experience, is always the same. In other words, the nature of an experience of hearing is the same as the nature of an experience of wanting a cookie, right? Or being irritated about today losing both telephone and internet service, and Comcast saying that they can't get a repair person out for 3 days until Saturday. Okay? That experience. You look at the nature of that experience. What's its nature? It's insubstantial. It's made up of parts. It's kind of quivering and changing. It's dynamic. And it, in some sense, arises and passes away impersonally. Doesn't need to have an owner. Okay? That's its nature. Right? And then you go out and you start recognizing more the nature of mind as a whole. And instantly, there's no problem. It's like, wow, mind as a whole. Open, spacious. Tibetan Buddhism's very articulate about this, kind of luminous, limitless. There's no bound to mind as a whole, right? And it has a sense of being pure. Mind itself is undefiled, as they say. A related metaphor here is that the mind is like a pool of water full of sediments with jewels at the bottom. And with practice, and the first what we do, disentangling from mind, disentangling from the doomed search. With those practices, the sediments gradually settle. You can feel that in any meditation session, usually. You can feel that over the course of your practice, your mind gets quieter. You're less and less troubled by things. Mind gets clearer and clearer. You can recognize that in other people. You know, someone you knew a while ago, you come back a year or two later, they've been doing some practice in their life. You know, it's not necessarily white light in India. You know, do some real practice. And you look at them and you realize there's less stuff between you. There's less ego there. There's less personality problem stuff there. Mind gets quieter. Sediments settle. And then the jewels are revealed. The jewels were always there. The light was always shining. The wonderful truth has always been the case. And water itself is always pure. The nature of water is undefiled. It's pure. every molecule of H2O is undefiled. It might hold toxic sludge, but the water itself is never stained or tainted or poisoned. It's always fine. In the same way, the mind, the nature of mind as a whole is pure and undefiled, as they say. So when you go out into mind as a whole, this moves more into practices of Dzogchen, or it's called Mahamudra, Rigpa, et cetera, people are much more trained than I am in those traditions. You know, I'm not trying to presume more knowledge than I have, but whatever terms we use, you know, the unconditioned, the deathless, the pure, the ground, the nameless, you know, you start to recognize, oh, the nature of mind as a whole is super cool. Of course, as soon as we conceptualize it and hold on to that experience and go, oh yeah, I'm going to rest his mind as a whole more and more, then I'll be really groovy. Then boom, we're immediately in trouble, of course. Okay? But these are practices. They've been very fruitful for me. They make sense neurologically, and I find them maybe described in other ways, in more traditional terms or more culturally non-Western terms, you know, fundamental to various traditions, this opening into mind as a whole. And then last, if you can, to develop more and more of, you could call it the oneness view, the allocentric view, if you prefer, the allness view, where you realize, whoa, and it really helps to, you realize this more when you go out into mind as a whole. You realize that, wow, mind as a whole, it's really obvious that whatever's buzzing and popping, like fizzy soda water, you know, in consciousness, is the result locally of vast networks of causes rippling through the tapestry of reality, manifesting right here. It's like a local ripple in allness. That's what's going on. So what's happening here in this moment of experience is an indication of, a reflection of this vast allness process. I mean, it's so easy to get very New Agey and trite about it, but to really realize you really are a local ripple of the universe as a whole. You know, atoms born inside literally exploding stars, dark energy, dark matter somehow interacting, you know, just evolution, human society, just whoa, it's all just rippling through. And that takes you into a lot of peace. And it undoes a lot of that strategy, you know, that doom strategy of seeking and suffering. So, finishing. The two sit alongside each other in terms of what we do when we practice, right? We practice the gradual purification of ourselves, the mind. We practice a disentangling from the machinery of desire. But if we don't also have some sense of what's also true, this practice can become pretty grim, and it can feel endless, and it can very easily be turned into one more subtle strategy for happiness that is doomed to failure and doomed to create suffering. And so I want to leave you with basically a kind of a question and an invitation. One view is that somehow out of, you know, kind of scratching and clawing our way through this life, let alone countless rebirths, potentially, somehow eventually we'll work our way to enlightenment, right? And a very different view is that it's actually possible multiple times a day to have an intimation of felt recognition, felt knowing of what's actually really true. And then in the moment, it may crumble because the causes and conditions are not yet fully developed. That's where the first way of practicing comes in, to kind of build, a garden that can be fertile soil, where it can increasingly stabilize these moments of awakening. But letting yourself have those moments of awakening and giving yourself the possibility that in this life you could be awakened. You know, do you think it's actually possible for yourself? You know, do you perhaps say to yourself, wow, I really am interested in awakening, at least a second or two a day, you know? One pinhole after another in the mud that obscures the stained glass windows through which the light is always eternally trying to shine, right? And then increasingly, if you can, you know, you experience yourself sort of lacy, foamy, more and more accessible. You just kind of give up more and more this project of self-improvement. The light starts shining through more and more. And that's what we do when we practice. Thank you for letting me go on for a while here. Why don't we leave it there? I'll be back next week. Let's just sit quietly for a minute or two and then continue to practice. Okay. Oops. I'd like to offer for you three, you could say, vows or wishes I routinely offer myself, and I'm going to say them for you each time I ring the bell. And the first of these is, for the sake of all beings, may you be awakened in this life. For the sake of all beings, may you be wakeful in this life. For the sake of all beings, may you be awake. Thank you.